Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Judy Blume Blooms Again edition, appropriate for spring. It's Wednesday, May 3rd, 2023. On today's show, Keri Russell returns in The Diplomat. It's on Netflix. It's a sort of political intrigue thriller about a career foreign officer who gets tapped to be our ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to England. Fun and mayhem ensue, I think is probably a fair way to put it. It also stars Rufus Sewell as her roguish husband and Michael McKean as the president. Many others, great ensemble cast. And then Judy Blume's groundbreaking coming-of-age novel finally makes it to the screen. Heather Schwedell will join us to discuss Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. And finally, what of the wedding, that ancient ritual rooted in everything we thought we'd evolved beyond, like patriarchy and gender norms and spending gross amounts of money? And anyway, we discuss a series of articles on the subject in Slate. Joining me today is Julia Turner of the LA Times. Hey, Julia.
Hello, hello.
And of course, Dana Stevens is the film critic of Slate. Hey, Dana.
Hey, hey, Steve.
The glory of being in the studio is I get to see your cool outfits today, capped off literally. That's an amazing cap.
Just wearing one of my many freebies that I get at the end of the year from various productions. Thanks, Ryan Johnson, for the baseball cap.
It says a Ryan Johnson whodunit, but doesn't have a title on it. So it's like,
because he has many more to roll out.
Many behind him, many more to come. Anyway, it's already a fetish object in my acquisitive mind. But all right, shall we make a show?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Okay. Keri Russell, she, of course, of Felicity and the Americans, returns now in The Diplomat. It's on Netflix and a big hit there. It's a political thriller from a former writer-producer of The West Wing and Homeland. It has great bloodlines, I suppose you could say. Russell plays Kate Wyler, a career behind-the-scenes sort of embassy diplomat type, who's out of the blue tapped to be the U.S. ambassador to England. She's suddenly thrust not only into a huge job, but into the limelight, which she's never sought out before. And also potential domestic presidential politics, all kinds of international intrigue. She's just suddenly in the thick of it, and for reasons she's only just beginning to grok. And most immediately, I should say, a British warship has been bombed in the Gulf. It throws everyone into a very West Wing-style high gear. It stars Rufus Sewell as her husband, an exceedingly complicated marriage. We'll get into it. And Michael McKean is a very, very Biden-esque president and a variety of others. In the clip, we're going to hear a good example of the ongoing conflict, really, at the center of the show, which is Kate's husband, Hal, played by Sewell, used to be ambassador himself, a very prominent one, in fact, and he keeps taking problems into his own hands. And here, Kate tells him to stop doing that. Let's listen.
You need to leave.
You need to eat something. You're bottoming out.
You need to leave this country. As soon as this lunch is over, you need to get on some plane, going someplace, and not be here anymore.
What are you?
You made an inappropriate outreach to a hostile power with whom we have no diplomatic relations. You made an investigation exponentially more difficult. You have so thoroughly fucked with my head, I can't think straight, or analyze information, or provide objective counsel. I can't do the fucking job if you are within a 100-mile radius. I am begging you, go.
Julia, let me start with you. This show's taken off. People I know are really talking about it. What'd you make of it?
This show is extremely fun. I will be so curious to hear if you guys agree with me, but I was trying to think what the right predecessor is. Obviously, Keri Russell, an extraordinary actress known for The Americans, truly, I think we will look back on as one of the great greats of the peak TV era. You know, the kind of bona fides of the creators with some West Wing experience. There's certainly like liberal fantasy television here. But I think actually the best antecedent I decided upon reflection is Scandal, because everything about the actual political setup of this seems like very flimsy and unrealistic. But then cast over that is sort of a set of human drama that is pretty fun and like well acted and decently realized. And it's a soap. It's like a soap in Britain with horses and carriages and spies. And it's pretty fun. I enjoyed this soap. Don't pop my bubble. What did you guys make of it?
Oh, dear. Okay, the bubble is wafting over to Dana. Are you?
It's a very pleasing bubble. The note that I have on this show is shave 20 points of IQ off the Americans.
You have this 20, show. Only 20.
But I think you're right, Julia, that we're thinking of the Americans because it's about Keri Russell being half of a couple who's doing all kinds of international espionage related things. But it really is. It is more of a meld of West Wing. And I didn't watch Scandal, but I'm aware of it, of that kind of glossy political soap. There's a comparison that Hal, the Rufus Sewell character, makes to Cinderella early in the show, where he says, just lean into the Cinderella aspect of this job, right? As she's balking at taking this very show pony kind of post. And the whole show really leans into the Cinderella thing. Another of the notes I had on it was, there's this ongoing trope in the Hunger Games books where Katniss Everdeen, the heroine, hates to get dressed up. She just hates it. She doesn't care about glamour at all. But oh dear, there must be a 3-page description of her gown. And this show completely has that, right? Like the Keri Russell character has this sort of butch side. I mean, she's very much a straight woman who has lots of straight good sex with her husband, but she has this side of not enjoying the girly bit of her job.
Right.
Yet the show is constantly forcing her into, as you said, horses and carriages and tea-length gowns and going to all these events. And so it really has this fantasy fulfillment kind of side to it as well, which I found extremely amusing.
Yeah. I mean, I would say a couple things about it. You know, it's like a deep state melodrama with a sort of reassuring through theme, which is that, you know, semi-authoritarian boobs run the world by and large, or seem to be trying to wag the tail of global politics continually. We've just gotten over with a, like, you know, a insuperably incompetent and really sort of evil president. We've moved on to a slightly dotty one who may not know what he doesn't know. And the Michael McKean character, who's clearly a Biden substitute in this. But of course, there has to be this subsurface layer of hyper-competent people who keep these people from ruining the world. You know, the super high-stakes, minute-by-minute game of just keeping the seat-of-the-pants leadership style of these demagogues and populist boobs and, you know, geriatric. All due respect to Joe Biden. And, you know, I mean, the show certainly indicates that this person is not really a boob, but they can't necessarily be trusted in the moment to be fully compos mentis or on point. The point is that they've done a very good job of taking the cards that they were dealt in order to do something that's reminiscent of West Wing, but without an admirable, you know, Clinton or Obama substitute at the heart of it, and done quite well. I would categorize this as there's dumb smart and there's smart dumb, right? And dumb smart is like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, Dumb and Dumber, like actually kind of smart movies made by very, very sharp, shrewd people that have this surface dumbness that actually doesn't go all that deep in some respects. And then there's smart dumb, which is, you know, I would characterize as a highly detailed behind the scenes sort of procedural where you get to eavesdrop on the quote unquote adults in the room that actually, as Julia says, is a basically high school melodrama about passing one another notes and people wanting to sleep with each other and like playing dress up and who's popular. And they've completely nailed that combination. And I love Keri Russell in this. I haven't yet watched The Americans. She is so good in this. I mean, if she weren't, it wouldn't carry. And then Rufus Sewell is phenomenal in it as this roguish husband who, I mean, he seems, I don't know whether this is the case, it seems sort of modeled on Richard Holbrooke, like a kind of legend in the ambassadorial world, who's an utter duplicitous rogue who may or may not have his wife's best interests at heart. And their marriage, there's almost like a screwball, a nasty screwball intensity to their marriage at the center of it, loving nasty screwball intensity of their marriage at the center of it. I'm all in. I think it's
it's a comedy of remarriage, right? Yep. Screwball style, 100%,
exactly.
Because they're splitting up, but they can't really split up because they kind of belong together because they're both so roguish and have the same kind of brain. And that's all played really well. I also love that it's kind of, there's a lot of sleeping around on the show and there's no judgment about it whatsoever.
Yeah.
I mean, I was so enjoying it, like just drinking it up. And then I was trying to think through, like, why do I not respect it or myself for enjoying it so much? Like, what is the exact... Steve, I do not know that I can parse the difference between smart, dumb, and dumb smart, and which one is the adjective and which one is the noun. But I was maybe like trying to engage a similar question, which is like, what? Why is this both great and not truly great? And I, of course, have been watching the final season of Succession, and I think there is a way in which, like, if you think about just how specific the characters on that show are, like how finely they are drawn, how particular the like psychological fuck-up-itude of Roman is, or the kind of wanting it always-ness of shit, like the acuteness of the psychological portraits of that show is incredibly precise. And in this show, because Keri Russell and Rufus Sewell are such great, charismatic, fun actors, their characters feel pretty fully realized, but the way that they're written and the way that the show is structured, they're like these types. And the types take on specificity because of the performance, but not because of what the show is actually doing. And they really can't, they don't have time for them to be more than types because there's so much plot. Like, and this is the scandal of it. Like, there's so much plot just in this first season, and the show is... It was number one on Netflix. It's still in the top five. It's just been renewed for a second season. You know, like, there's no time for them to have too much character because they've got to move on to the next twist and the next turn. But it was sort of like thinking of that comparison that helped me put my finger on, like, both what was great about this show and what was sort of less than, like, extraordinary about it.
I would say that it's a unexpected strength of the show, given everything Julia said, that they seem to have worked out to a reasonable degree of plausibility, or at least kind of seductive intricacy, the mechanics of the intrigue, right? So it's if you called it verisimilitude, you're a just ridiculous sucker, but it's not lazy, is I guess what I'm saying. They've decided to make an elaborate drawing, whether it refers to a thing in the real world precisely or not. It's elaborately constructed, drawn, shaded in parts, and it is the medium through which these actors get to relate to one another and be angry at each other and dramatic and establish sexual tension and on and on and on. And that's not, I don't think that's easy to do. Someone took the care to build this universe that may be fake, but make it internally coherent, intricate, and compelling. I actually think it's dumb. Like, not dumb, but it's like it's smart dumb. I keep coming back to it, like this meaningless category.
No, the analogy of the drawing really, really works. There's a whole piece in Slate by Fred Kaplan, who writes, among other things, on diplomacy and foreign affairs and things like that, about how utterly ridiculous the whole premise of the show is. That, for example, just the fact that the British ambassador, the American ambassador to Britain, is always... By essence, a significant political figure who got it as a fancy sinecure, right? It's not someone obscure who they're sort of trying to promote through back channels and all the things this show presupposes. So I don't doubt Fred Kaplan. I'm sure that this is absolutely untrue to the way, you know, actual diplomacy works. But you're right that within the laws of its universe, it's consistent. And most of all, it's just fun.
It's fun to watch. I mean, Julia, bear in mind that some of us, and I'm not going to name which one of the three of us, some of us spend inordinate time reading the comments section of a certain Jets blog. And the owner of the Jets is Woody Johnson, a Johnson & Johnson heir, and one of the great boobs, like born on third base, thought he hit a triple boobs who's ever lived. And he is our last ambassador to England under Trump. And so the joke on the blog is, imagine casting Woody Johnson in the Carrie Russell role or part. This, like, complete lost moron. I mean, you know, it's just, that's where one has to remember, like, this is just the sinecure to end all sinecures. The idea that this person is at the heart of a, you know, shitstorm and keeping the world intact is just hilariously.
Yeah, it would be an Iannucci film if a real life ambassador was cast into this
exactly.
scenario, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the kind of pleasing tensions of the show is that it is, like, on its face preposterous. I mean, I enjoyed reading Fred Kaplan's high dudgeon about the piece, but, like, you don't need to be Fred Kaplan to be like, wait, what? like one of the conceits of the show, I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say this because it's revealed in the pilot, but one of the conceits of the show is that the reason that this kind of, like, real world back channel operative who has no time for fancy dresses has been promoted to this functionary position is that she's actually secretly being groomed to be the vice president, which what? Like,
what?
That doesn't really make sense. But the thing that's sort of pleasing and has this pleasing tension about it is that, and this is where it does echo the West Wing, that the finely detailed, completely false drawing that you describe, Steve, like, it gives that same pleasure that the West Wing does of, like, this is how it really works. And that's what's so funny about it, is that it gives you this panache of, like, we're letting you in. This is how it really works. Like, you just see the helicopter landing on TV, but behind the scenes, the butlers are doing this and the diplomats are saying that. And yet, it's all clearly not true. So, like, how is it giving me that pleasure when it's so clearly telling me, like, a fable about that at the same time? But I will absolutely snack this up and season two. It's delectable and enjoyable, so cue it up.
Ida, does she become Veep? Does their marriage survive? I'm all in. All right, it's called The Diplomat. Check it out. If you like it or don't like it, let us know. All right, let's move on.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
All right, before we go any further, this is typically where we discuss business. Dana, what do we got?
Steve, we have but one item of business this week, and that is to tell listeners about today's Slate Plus segment. This week, we're talking about Google Maps. We got this idea after reading an article in The Atlantic by Will Peischel that's called "A Refuge from Internet Algorithms is Hiding in Plain Sight." It's mostly about the reviews on Google Maps and what the experience of surfing them is like, but we're going to talk in a larger sense about Google Maps as an app, our own relationship to it, how we use it, if we like it. I think it's actually a really rich topic, and I can't wait to discuss it with you guys. So if you're a Slate Plus member, you will hear that at the end of this show. And if you're not a Slate Plus member, you can sign up at slate.com/culture plus. In exchange for signing up for Slate Plus, you get ad-free podcasts, you get bonus content like the segment I just described, and lots of other shows have them too, and you get unlimited access to all of the writing on slate.com. You'll never hit a paywall when you belong to Slate Plus, and you'll also be supporting the magazine and the journalism that our wonderful colleagues are doing. These memberships matter a lot to Slate, so please sign up today at slate.com/culture plus. Once again, that's slate.com/culture plus. All right, back to the show.
All right, well, the movie Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret has just been released. It's based, of course, on the groundbreaking young reader classic by Judy Blume, the author Judy Blume, the 1970 novel. Took this long to come to the screen, as I understand it, because she didn't really want it made. There's another Blumeissance going on. There have been several, I've been informed, over the past many decades due to a series of snafus. I was not able to see the movie, so we're right now joined by Slate staff writer Heather Schwedell to pinch hit for me. Heather, thank you so much for coming in and joining us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
All right. This version, I should say, is written for the screen and directed by Kelly Freeman Craig. It stars Abby Ryder Fortson as the title character, also Rachel McAdams, Kathy Bates, and others. In the clip we're about to hear, Margaret's mom takes her bra shopping for the first time. Why don't we listen?
Excuse me. We're looking for a bra for my daughter.
Well, we don't have many that small. But come with me, dear. I'll measure you. Arms up, dear. Barely a 28, not even a double A. Your best bet is going to be to go with one of these grow bras here. So one day when you do grow, it'll grow with you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks. We'll just go try it on. Here we go. This is always the tough bit. I can't even do this to this day. Okay. How's that feel?
I cannot wait to take it off.
Yeah. Welcome to womanhood.
Oh, man. I'm so sorry I missed this movie. Dana, you were really enthusiastic about it, as I understand. This novel is, it's just a milestone in many young readers' lives, including at least one of my daughters. And here it is finally, and you admired it, yes?
I loved the movie. Yeah. Absolutely loved. I'm very curious to hear from Heather and Julia what their history with the book is, because I'm sure I read the book. Because it was just there. It was omnipresent in my childhood, as all of Judy Blume's big novels of the time were. But I don't have any strong memory of the book. And I think by the time I read it, I was already reading adult literature. I kind of went straight from, you know, reading the same kids' books over and over to just pulling books off my parents' shelves and reading them. And my memory of these kind of books, which are not quite YA, but I guess middle grade readers, right? I mean, YA was not really as much of a thing at the time, is that they were sort of there and I read them, but they weren't necessarily formative for me. But then on watching this movie and then sort of accompanying some of this Judy Blume renaissance you're talking about, like watching the great new documentary about her on Amazon and hearing her on Fresh Air last week, and just she's everywhere right now in the culture. And then you sort of realize, you have one of those retroactive realizations like, oh, yeah, without Judy Blume, I probably wouldn't have half of the attitudes that I have, right? The sort of less hung up than my mother's generation attitudes about things like menstruation or having sex in high school, other things she wrote about, right? Masturbation, she wrote about in her book, Dini. And I think I grew up in some sort of late 70s atmosphere where that was just accepted. But now, when you look at the culture wars that are happening and the, you know, Florida school children that are being forbidden from even talking about menstruation in elementary school, and, you know, the absurd level of, you know, repression that's coming back now, those were precious times, you know? I mean, I think I didn't realize that in relation to that and in relation to abortions being available and normal, right? That was just, in fact, a brief blip in history that I was living in. And so realizing that made this movie seem special and important, and the book seemed special and important in a way it hadn't at the time. Also, that was all background, but let's get to the actual movie itself, the film by Kelly Freeman Craig. It's a great movie, and it's the kind of movie that never makes it to the theater anymore. I mean, I think it's more of really a film for adult women than for children and young women, and I wonder what you two think of that. Because Rachel McAdams, the mother character, is a much bigger character than she is in the book. She has her own arc. You know, she's a working mother who gives up her job to move to the suburbs, as Judy Blume did in the 1960s. And that's all an add-on from the book that I think makes the movie work incredibly well. And Rachel McAdams and Abby Ryder Fortson are both fabulous together. They seem so much like mother and daughter. Last thing I'll say is that I saw this with my mother. I took her to a press screening, and it was an unusual treat to get to see this particular movie with her. And we both loved it and cried.
I also saw this movie with my mother, and we both loved it and cried. Like, I never see movies with my mother. That's so funny that you did.
That is an odd coincidence. But Julie, you have a very different history with the book, right? I think you have strong negative feelings about Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, the book. And I wanted to know about that.
I do. And then watching this movie made me wonder if it's just yet another book that I misapprehended in my smarty pants youth. But I remember, so I read a ton of Judy Blume. I think like you, Dana, I probably read it all you know, young, because I read, you know, I probably read it in like second grade rather than middle school, and then, you know, was reading grown-up books by the time I was actually thinking about puberty in any real way. But I remember it as like the alienating book about periods, because the main, in my memory, and again, maybe not true, the main character is like so obsessed with her own physical maturation and getting her period and when she's going to get her period. And then also that because it's written in the 70s, like it describes her curiosity about an entanglement with like the period technology of the time, which in my memory in the book includes like using a belt of some kind, which is no longer what the technology requires. And she like practices with the belt. Like there was just this kind of concern and obsession about the period and the apparatus of the period just did not square with either my lived experience when I read the book, which was probably like too young to actually have thoughts about periods, but or my lived experience of like a person anticipating getting and then eventually getting a period. Like it just was never that big of a deal, but not in a way that made me, I mean, I also love Judy Blume's books. I read all of them, again, read them young, I think, but they are wonderful and, you know, sort of like family dramas, and their frankness about all these subjects didn't feel radical in my 80s childhood. It just felt normal. And I think you're right, Dana, to sort of look to prize that frankness, especially as it seems under threat at the moment.
I'm so glad you brought up the belt. I remember the belt from the book very well. And I think I had maybe more of a typical experience with this book. I read it and loved it at the time. I don't think I had any complicated negative feelings about it. But it's also not one that I would have ever thought of as a touchstone or a favorite book. So one thing I really appreciated about the movie is there were certain things in it I did remember really well. There's a character who, when she gets her period, she sends a postcard, and it only says three words: "I got it." And I loved that, and I remembered that. So it was just really lovely to me the way this book did sort of sneak into my psyche, and it's still there. And in that same way, I was wondering, I wish they had portrayed the belt. I sort of understand why they didn't. It's this outdated technology. I guess before pads had, it was easy to put like stickers or adhesives on pads. They were held up with a belt. And I was sort of looking forward to seeing that in the movie, because that was one of the fascinating things in the book that I found interesting. I guess it would have been sort of a distraction to portray it. But I also think it was interesting what Dana said about this being a movie for adults, because, you know, I can't see it now as anything other than an adult, but I think I would have liked it as a child. And I was sort of touched to see, I think there was about a 10-year-old girl in my screening, which I thought was lovely, but it's also rated PG-13, which was surprising to me.
It's so interesting what you say about the belt, Heather, because actually I feel like one of my experiences of reading the book was like, this is no longer relevant. Like being a woman used to be so difficult with the belts, but like I live in the future and women can do anything. And Geraldine Ferraro ran for vice president, and like these sad women of the past with their belts. Like I think I had like a kind of... there was like a specificity to the 70s-ness of it, even from the mid-80s, that, you know, I like whatever. It is probably the wrong way to have read it or thought about it. But I think the book is so set in time that I wonder if it would have been interesting to include that.
Yeah, I think the movie, it does make certain choices. I like that it was still set in the 70s.
The clothes are fantastic, by the way. Absolutely great costumes by Anne Roth.
They really mm-hmm. are. And it sort of reminds me of the Roald Dahl thing of, you know, I don't want these things to be updated for now. I want the original text. But then there are certain things. I was also wondering about, the movie doesn't actually show any blood. And that's something that I only sort of noticed at the very end. Not to give any spoilers, but someone does get their period, and it's sort of specifically shot around in a way that I was kind of like, huh. And it did seem a little old-fashioned or of a different era. If the whole point of this movie and this story is to normalize and make women feel comfortable with their bodies, and this is not this gross thing, like, why couldn't they show, like, a little speck of blood?
Especially if it's PG-13, right? I mean, what is the PG-13 rating actually about? This movie has no sex. It has barely any cursing. There's nothing really frightening or raunchy about it. So it does seem like if you're going to give it the PG-13, at least show the blood. At the same time, I noticed that at the time, too, in that scene. And also thought, well, maybe this makes a certain kind of sense in that it's offering some privacy and discretion to the character, right? Which maybe in a way adds to a young girl's sense of her dignity in watching it. And that maybe this is, I think, also maybe why the belt was left off. It makes it less scary to an 11-year-old girl, Margaret's age, who's watching it thinking, I don't know if I want this to happen, right? I mean, there may be something a little soft-pedaling about not showing blood, but I can also see how that could be a generous or respectful decision. I mean, these are all interesting questions, but I want to make the point just to veer off of the menstruation topic for a minute, that the movie and the book, too, is about much more than that. And even the title kind of gives that away. It really is, in many ways, about this spiritual search of Margaret, the main character, who is in this interfaith family. She has a Jewish dad, secular Jewish dad, and a lapsed Christian mom who has fallen out of touch with her fundamentalist parents. That's all from the book, too. And so there's a lot in the movie about her searching for meaning in the world and, you know, how to live in the world as a person without God, which is a very big question for an 11-year-old to be wrestling with. And I really, really respect that the movie, like the book, takes that quest really seriously. There's something about the tone of this movie that is just, I think, so hard to strike, that it's about a child who really is played by a child and acts like a kid her age, but who is grappling with a lot of big questions. And It's just beautifully done. It reminded me in some ways of movies like Freaky Friday, you know, another movie for kids, but that is completely watchable by adults and is about real things and people struggling with real problems, but in a way that is accessible and maybe fun for young and older people to experience together.
Amazing. All right. Well, the movie is Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. It's out in theaters now. Check it out and let us know what you thought. Heather, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
All right. Well, statistically speaking, marriage is on the downswing. It's down about 60%, the number of weddings over the last 50 years in this country. Not to mention, of course, I think, as we all know, gender norms are being scrambled. It raises an interesting question. Why are people still getting married? How are they getting married? How has the institution evolved? Is it going extinct? And if it isn't, why? We discuss a series of Slate articles. Let me quote here, a pop-up Slate series about the unsettled state of the American wedding. So it surged last year, Dana, coming out of COVID. Understandably, people had delayed and delayed. But COVID is something of a great reset, a great rethink. And I do think it's a relevant question. Like, why does this kind of archaic and weird in some ways, given the way a general ethos about gender itself and gender relations and commitment and on and on and on and on. These have changed radically. Where is marriage now? What'd you take away from this series of pieces?
I mean, it was a really, really fun package. I recommend that people flip through this bunch of articles about weddings, which take it on from every angle, from, you know, trends in wedding dresses to, you know, the destination wedding. I guess COVID or no COVID, I've had these questions about weddings forever. And I'm really, I don't know if we've had this as a topic before, this type of general question about the tradition of getting married in front of people, but it's something that has always puzzled me, and which is why I never wanted to do it myself. But yeah, there is something strangely persistent about even some of the most, what seemed to me, patriarchal of these traditions, like the white dress. I don't think I had realized how recent the white dress tradition is until reading that piece on Slate about the tradition of the white gown. I guess I knew it was something from the 19th century, but it's actually apparently Queen Victoria's wedding in 1840 that kind of set the standard that you get married in white, right? And it's just slowly grown, you know, spread throughout the globe since then. And here we are, stuck still with this emblem of virginity, right, connected to the woman being given away, another patriarchal tradition. I even find the ring, you know, the idea that you have to have this visual symbol. It's sort of like a brand on cattle or something like that. I mean, excuse me to anyone who's wearing a wedding ring, but this is just for me. Like, I'm just speaking for my own personal psychology. I never identified with any of those traditions and find them alien, but they seem to be strangely persistent, even in this era, as you say, of everything else shifting and changing. So it seems like the size of weddings is changing. They're getting smaller, right? They're getting more sort of focused and customized and personalized, and people are expressing their culture a bit more than before. But when it comes to the old gender norms and the idea of, you know, purity and being given away and all of these things, it seems strangely hard to shake. At the same time, I say this as if I'm some sort of, you know, utter critique. I mean, I just went to a great wedding last weekend. Yeah. The bride wore white. I had a wonderful time. It was a great event. As a guest at weddings, I get why you want to have a celebration and have your family there and what a meaningful day it is. But as someone participating in it, I'm always amazed that even some of my most, you know, progressive friends who live in ways that are outside the norm in other circumstances show up at their wedding, and what the hell are they wearing? A white dress. Who's giving them away? Their dad. I don't know. I'm sounding like such a curmudgeon here. I think you should throw it to Julia.
Julia, let's begin with just how radically different it is to be one of the two spouses, future spouses, you know, and one of the guests, right? I found being in my own wedding tremendously alienating and out of body, as many people I think describe it. It's sort of for everybody else in some sense.
Partly why I never wanted one. My parents described their wedding in that way. Yeah. They said we felt like it was out of our hands and it was just a day that other people were controlling, and that never appealed to me. Not that everyone has to feel that way.
No, not at all. But I don't think it's uncommon to feel that way. And yet many people really loved our wedding and really loved being there and remember it extremely fondly and on and on. And relatedly, Julia, I loved being at your wedding. I really got a sense of how both you and your partner's families, in an extended sense, really spread and intertwined with one another, and just like the deep tentacles of affection and support that both of you had in the world. And like it, that energy was in the room. I met people who made it even more concrete for me. It was like I really quite loved your wedding. It was for what it's worth. And so it's just, I see both sides of this. I'm curious where you come out on it.
I got married in a white dress and my dad walked me down the aisle. And I loved my wedding. I had a great wedding. I mean, the thing that felt subversive about our wedding is that we got engaged in January and married in early May. Going to be my anniversary coming on up here. And so we did a 14-week. We cabined all of the prep and stress into 14 weeks. And it was fantastic. Like, strong recommend to anybody who doesn't want the wedding to eat their life. You can put on a wedding in that amount of time. You can find a venue. You can find a dress. You can pick out plates. And then you're done. And you don't have to think about it anymore. I think it costs a little bit more sometimes to rush things. It was maybe not the most economic way to do a wedding. But I mean, just to zoom out now as both no longer the bride and also no longer the generation of person who goes to weddings, you know, 2 to 10 times a year in the sort of like coupling up phase of life. I'm going to float a theory here that I'm not sure I'm fully behind. So tell me what you guys think about it. But I feel like modern life does not provide enough opportunities for like gathering, revelry, joy, drink, and like a happy mix of people you know well and pleasant strangers. Like, it's not, you know, I don't know, you can sort of find it in the world, but it's, you get, especially as you get further into middle age, it's just like harder to scare that up. It's fun. So I feel like all of these coupling up partners sort of have this social burden of like providing venues like this for the rest of us to kind of see and be seen and observe people's attire and comportment and admire or judge, be moved to joy or scandalized by the like idiot toast of the drunk best man, or, you know, I don't know. It's just like a pageant. You're putting on a pageant. And that is what is so alienating about it. I mean, I remember when we were getting married, realizing like, okay, especially if you're someone who's never wanted to be the center of attention, which is maybe more true of my partner than me, but like you are writing, producing, starring in, and directing a play for everyone you've ever known or liked about your most intimate relationship and the entire future of your life. Like, that's a crazy thing to do. No wonder it's stressful. Like, it's wild. But, you know, I mean, I thought the sleep package was great. And I also, it was interesting reading it because it just feels less and less as, you know, various people challenge gender. Like, there's just fewer, there's a less oppressive set of norms to argue against. Like, I have so much respect and admiration for people who didn't want to deal with the trappings of it and who've constructed their lives in their own way and didn't want to put on a dress or have a party or whatever it is. Like, the choices you make seem totally in keeping with you and your spirit, Dana, and don't, you know, like your partnership and relationship is your partnership and relationship. It has nothing to do with what kind of party you did or didn't throw at a particular juncture where you made a particular decision about the your level of commitment to your relationship, right? And like, I guess I also feel the same about mine. Like, I don't know, we felt like throwing a party. We wanted to celebrate. I like clothes. I got a fancy dress. It didn't. I feel like my feminist bona fides and personhood just seem independent of the choices we made about that party. But I will say, I will tell my favorite story from our wedding. Maybe it's not my favorite, but a story from our wedding, which is like, you can just control the day. Like, you can't control the day, but you can. Because we planned it so hastily, we maybe didn't communicate everything we needed to everyone, including our DJ. And although we had sort of a semi-Jewish secular wedding and we stomped the glass and there was a ketubah, we didn't want to do the chair thing. Like, it wasn't that Jewish of a wedding. It seems honestly terrifying to be up in the chairs. It was like more center of attentioniness at the end. Like, it was too much. We didn't want to do the chairs. But somebody got the idea that we should do the chairs and told the DJ, and he started playing the song. But we had like finished our toasts and we were having our cake and we just continued sitting in the corner at a table eating cake. And then they turned the song off and we didn't do the chairs because they didn't want to do the chairs and it was our fucking wedding. So like, you can just resist the oppression of the day if you want. It was a funny moment, but like also a fine one.
Yeah, exactly. It occurs to me, maybe this is what we're getting at perhaps, which is that if you're part of if you have been historically categorized because of your preferences or lifestyle as the other and been excluded from these kinds of rituals, I could understand embracing it, if you see what I mean. Like, gay marriage. Why was gay marriage considered and it should have been a non-negotiable human right, right? I mean, for all the obvious reasons, right? The experience of the ritual is one of exclusion, you know, othering and possible belittlement. And so gay friends of mine who get married, it's like there's something really deeply celebratory about it and cannot in a billion years, I think, be interpreted as somehow patriarchal concession or something. And that has an interesting relationship to how it can liberate everybody else to appropriate from it what they want and creatively, as Julia did in hers, like creatively manipulate it or delete portions, heighten others, and make of it what they will, or not do it at all, right? I mean, it's like, in that sense, kind of a wonderful thing. The way in which freedom has been conferred on everybody as a consequence of the end of the closet, for example.
Yeah, and you can confer your own meaning on things. Like, to me, my dad walking me down the aisle, like, I'm so glad he did, you know? He's since died, and it was never about him giving me away. And my parents actually, and I maybe would have rankled if they weren't, but they would have been, like, so offended and irritated if my husband had asked them permission to marry me. Like, what the fuck? Definitely not up to them, you know? Like, that particular thing, I think, would have rankled. I mean, whatever. I wouldn't have been marrying someone who thought they should do that, obviously. And they would have felt like that meant I was with the wrong person if that had happened. But, you know, like you grow up in a family of girls with a dad, like he was my main man for a while. And then I was like partnering up with a new guy. Like it was sort of a, it wasn't like a giving away, but it was just kind of a moment about our relationship. And I loved it. It was great.
Yeah, and I'm sure I teared up when that happened, Julia. So no. I can be called out on my, you know, marching to City Hall grimly, kind of pleasure denying history when I think about attending your wedding and how special that was to me.
No,
I think,
but there's no calling out. You shouldn't have marched. You should like you marched to City Hall joyfully. Like that's what was right for you.
Actually, I was sort of frog marched to City Hall. I didn't even want to get married in the first place. But see, I take it so far that I think I just don't identify with the institution. I mean, beyond not wanting to perform the intimacy that Julia was talking about, I just don't like the idea that the state has anything to say about my relationship. And I remember at the time that, you know, I marched to City Hall. It was because we were going to have a baby. And I thought, okay, so probably, you know, whatever, for tax reasons or legal reasons or something, we should probably have this piece of paper. But it was never a thing that I identified with as, you know, this is a rite of passage for my relationship. And that probably speaks to my own deep psychological hangups or something. But yeah, never had the desire for that. But please, everybody out there, keep inviting me to your weddings because wedding dancing is the best dancing.
There we go. Okay, well, this pop-up package on Slate is called Say Yes to the Mess. There's a lot of rich material in there. And if you have thoughts on this, I have to imagine a lot of listeners do. Please shoot us an email. We love hearing from you. Let's move on.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
if we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
All right, now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse. Dana, what do you have?
Stephen, inspired by a small role in The Diplomat, I'm going to endorse Rory Kinnear's performance as Hamlet in the National Theater back in 2010. Rory Kinnear is this actor whose face I'm sure you know, even if you don't know his name. If you follow British TV at all, he's omnipresent. He was also, I think, in the last three or four James Bond movies. But principally, he's a classically trained stage actor. And because of my theater nerd daughter, I know that he played an incredible Hamlet, a very specific and unusual and weird Hamlet in 2010 for the National Theater. And it was broadcast live. You know, those things where they show theater live in a cinema and you go and watch it on a certain night. It's also now available on the National Theater app, which I believe I was trying to figure this out for our listeners, and they may have to do some scouting based on where they live. I think if you're in the U.S., you need to get an add-on for the National Theater Live for free on various platforms, and then you can watch various National Theater emissions from the past. So the 2010 Rory Kinnear Hamlet. I think it was the first Hamlet my daughter ever saw all the way through, and maybe that's why it blew her away so much, but it is a really extraordinary performance in that role.
Oh, man, I got to go see that, because I will confess that, remember that very, 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 very bad Alex Garland movie we talked about?
Men. Yes, of course.
That stars Rory Kinnear as all the bad men. Like, it really took me the first several episodes of this show to be like, ugh, get that gross movie off of this guy.
That movie is truly bad. You notice that I did not cite it in my attempt to conjure up who Rory Kinnear is. But anyway, in Diplomat, he's also very good. He plays this sort of very Brexity, you know, right-wing nationalist PM of Britain. And he's quite funny and sharp in it. And he's very shape-shifting. I guess in Men, he's shape-shifting in the worst way.
Yeah.
CGI-aided shape-shifting.
The masculine slime aftertaste turns out to actually sort of work for the character. But I did, just for the first few times he was on scene, I was like, oh my God, is that role just going to ruin his whole career? I guess not. Hopefully not.
Oh, he's also so incredible in Peterloo. Oh, that's another whole conversation. But the Mike Lee movie, Peterloo, he plays a major role, and it's a fantastic film.
That's so good. Julia, what do you have?
Hollywood's writers are, as of yesterday evening, now on strike, which is an absolutely seismic story. Hasn't happened for more than 15 years. And we will no doubt be talking about it in more detail next week. It was not quite clear whether this strike would be averted and or would be postponed. So we'll be talking more about it soon. But I would encourage our listeners to subscribe to The Wide Shot, which is our newsletter at the LA Times covering the business of Hollywood for ongoing analysis. This is a major story with much to say about the economics of entertainment. We will be digging in further, but The Wide Shot will also keep you good company through these travails.
Oh, I just signed up for it now while you were talking, Julie. I didn't know about The Wide Shot. And I'm trying to keep an eye on the strike because it's a huge, huge issue that we'll probably be talking about at some point on this show.
Yeah, as soon as next episode. All right. So this is, I think we've all spent, I'm going to guess, about a decade or more attempting to outshine John Swansburg, who came in and endorsed a little-known TV show called Cheers. And
never forget when I endorsed Chinatown, a fine film. But yes, continue.
The blueness of the sky, a little band called the Beatles, you know. I mean, anyway, I kind of am trending in that direction. I don't think I have the trump card to end all trump cards here when I say that I am finally really digging in and watching the TV show High Maintenance. And it's just wildly behind the curve for the host of a culture podcast. But I liked it when I first saw it. I saw, you know, maybe a handful of episodes of the first HBO season when we talked about it. I liked it well enough. I didn't feel compelled to go back. How wrong I was. I think one should try to keep the word masterpiece in one's mouth for as long as you can until you can't help it. And I'm sort of there. I think the show's actually kind of a masterpiece. It's just so true to its own rhythms, moods, sensibility. For those who don't know it, it's about a pot dealer in New York in the pre-legalization era, but you know, he's on a bike, he's a bike courier, and you know, but what it really is this very slowly, carefully, patiently built mosaic of the borough of Brooklyn in the teens and beyond, made with astonishing nuance, subtlety, and a refinement and precision for the medium, and quite beautiful and empathetic and forgiving, while being very true to each one of the subcultures that it enters. I love it. I mean, I really love it. I admire it almost boundlessly. Yeah, Dana, I'm not wrong, right, about this. It's unique, really. It really is unique. It's like nothing else I can think of.
Yeah, I'm glad you've come to this, in, even if it's late in cheer style. But I was just going to say, if you'll permit me to be a complete hipster, that really the best High Maintenance of all is the web series High Maintenance before it went on HBO. And I think we may have talked about it on the show when it was just a web series, because it was somewhat of a groundbreaking, you know, it got a really big audience for a web-only show at the time. And what's really unusual about the era when it was a web series is that there's no standardized length to the episodes. So some of them are 12 minutes long. Some of them are 30, 40 minutes long. And then, of course, when they moved to HBO, they standardized it to half an hour. I still loved it. I watched it all the seasons, however many there were on HBO. But I always felt like the kernel of that show, when it was just this thing that two people who were married at the time were making together for the web, for whatever audience would tune in and stream it, was really, really special. So you have that to look forward to when you finish
Absolutely.
All of the HBO episodes.
I cannot wait. All right. Well, thanks, Dana. Fun show.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Thank you, Julia.
Thank you.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page at slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Our introductory music is by Nicholas Bertel. Our production assistant is Jessica Balderrama. Our producer is Cameron Drews. For Dana Stevens and Heather Schwedell and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you soon.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.